Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest this week grew up in Danbury, Connecticut, and earned a literature degree from Yale University. He is the author of 2 New York Times number 1 best-selling biographies, and children's books and scripts for VeggieTales. He is the voice of Breakpoint, a daily broadcast carried by 1,400 radio outlets. His latest book is entitled 7 Men and the Secret of Their Greatness. His name, Eric Metaxas, and we're honored to have him as our guest. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to Eric Metaxas, who gave the keynote speech at the 2012 National Prayer Breakfast. Eric, welcome. A real honor to have you.
Well, a pleasure to be with you and to speak to your audience.
Can we start by talking about your childhood and what you learned from your mom and your dad?
My childhood was a wonderful childhood. I thank the Lord for my childhood. My mom and dad, who are thankfully still with us, came over as immigrants from Europe. My dad came from Greece. My mom came from Germany. They met in an English class here in New York City, in Manhattan, learning the English language, immigrants in the 1950s. And they were married, and I was born in 63, so I'm exactly 50 years old this month. And I had it, in a way, a very typical American upbringing, and in some ways not very typical at all. I have to say that the most typical part of it is that, you know, most Americans come from somewhere, and my parents, as I say, came from Europe, had a traditional upbringing, patriotic, stable family, all that kind of stuff. I went to the Greek Orthodox Church, really didn't get a foundation in the gospel or in scripture. It was mostly, I would say, traditional. It was a wonderful, warm environment. But I never really met Jesus, never learned how to pray, none of that stuff. And by the time I got to college, I was woefully unprepared for the secularist environment that I would encounter.
Where did you get your love for writing?
Well, that's one of those things. All I can say is I got it from God, because I have no clue. I did not grow up in a house where we read. We watched TV. I always had an affinity for words when I was in school, in high school especially, just found that I liked English, history, wasn't so keen on math and science. I just, you know, God makes us as he makes us. And I found myself, you know, absolutely having this affinity for words and language, but didn't know what to do with it, didn't have a place to go with it. When I got to Yale, suddenly I started to exercise my writing abilities, writing short stories, writing poetry, writing humor, in a way, meeting people who had a love for that same kind of thing. So for the first time ever, this would be in my late teens at college, I just found myself wanting to do this kind of thing, wanting to reproduce great words and sentences. I say reproduce, in a way, wanting to reproduce the Western canon. Here I am reading all this great literature from Homer all the way up through Milton and into the 20th century, and I thought, I want to be part of this grand tradition somehow. It's so beautiful. It's so meaningful. I mean, it's dealing with meaning itself. That's what appealed to me, the language, and then this grappling with the meaning of life.
Then you start writing scripts for VeggieTales. You write 30 children's books.
I got out of college in 84, graduated in 84, didn't know God, didn't know myself, totally lost. I will skip to the good part. In 1988, after I'd moved in with my parents, I was just miserable, floundering, trying to be a writer, unhappy, confused, lost. God broke through and met me in a dream. Actually, the account of that, it's on my website, which is ericmetaxas.com. It's been published just this month in Christianity Today. I have never told the story of my dramatic conversion in words before until just now, on the 25th anniversary of my coming to faith, and Christianity Today has published it, but I got it on my website. It was the most dramatic thing. I went to sleep one night, had a dream, the Lord spoke, I woke up, and Jesus came into my life. I mean, it's one of those things you hear people talk about it, but it happened to me. It's an extraordinary story. I won't give it away, but it just, you know, I've never written about it until now, and coincidentally, if you believe in coincidences, which I don't, it appears in Christianity Today exactly 25 years after it happened. But it changed everything, and suddenly I said, okay, God, what do you have for me? I want to write, but I don't know what I want to do. I haven't been very successful up to this point. I'm living with my parents. I'm miserable. You take over. What do you want me to do with my life? And dramatically and miraculously, I don't use that word lightly, I won't tell the details, but it was quite miraculous turn of events. God just lifted me up out of this miserable job and within hours gave me another job. It was one of those crazy things that happens in your life and you say, this sure doesn't seem like it's just happening. It feels like God's hand is moving in a way that's palpable to me. And I found myself writing children's books for a company called Rabbit Ears Productions. I never wanted to write children's books, never dreamt I would write children's books, started writing all these children's books. And, of course, that led a number of years later to VeggieTales hiring me to be a writer. And so I had the privilege of working at VeggieTales. I didn't write much for them, but I did write a few things. I wrote the book God Made You Special, and I wrote half of the Lyle the Kindly Viking video, which the half I wrote is the Hamlet Omelet parody. They gave me this incredible assignment. They said, we want you to do a Shakespeare parody for VeggieTales. You're a Yale English major. What do you say? And I had the joy of thinking, okay, if I were to write a Shakespeare parody for VeggieTales, what would it be? So I wrote the Hamlet Omelet parody, and that appears in the Lyle the Kindly Viking video. And then I even had a greater crazy joy and privilege of being the voice of the narrator on the Esther video. Their Esther video, they needed a narrator, and they allowed me to goof around and use my New York accent. So I did that. So I just, what a joy to work for VeggieTales. Just a great joy in my life.
Esther, the girl who became queen. We're talking to Eric Metaxas. His website again, Eric, Metaxas. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Rasula, and we're with Eric Metaxas, the author of two acclaimed New York Times best-selling biographies, one on William Wilberforce and the other on Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Eric, how did you ever get into writing biographies of great people?
Well, it's just like how I got into writing children's books. It had nothing to do with me or what I wanted to do. It's one of the ironies of life. I was not interested in writing biographies. I was not interested in writing children's books. If you talked to me years ago and said, what are the genres that you like? I never would have mentioned either of those. But as I said a moment ago, I wrote over 30 children's books, worked for VeggieTales, and then suddenly found myself writing biographies. How that happened was I wrote a book of apologetics with the title Everything You Always Want to Know About God But Were Afraid to Ask. I even wrote a sequel, Everything Else You Always Want to Know About God But Were Afraid to Ask. And the third one, Everything You Always Want to Know About God But Were Afraid to Ask, the Jesus edition. I was really obsessed with sharing my faith in a fun way, Q&A that people could read, you could give to your neighbors. And in the course of writing the first one, I mentioned a man who took the Bible so seriously that he changed the world, and that was William Wilberforce. But I only mentioned him briefly. I mean, it's just a paragraph in this whole book, which is just apologetics about the Bible and Scripture and, you know, all the stuff that skeptics would ask. How can a good God allow suffering? Do angels and demons exist? All that stuff that people have questions about. Just had a paragraph on Wilberforce. I found myself, Jack, if you can believe it, on CNN talking about this book. Now, CNN doesn't have Christian apologists on all that often, so this was kind of amazing in and of itself. And the host, instead of asking me a hard question, asks me this softball question, says, hey, what's this here about Wilberforce? Sounds interesting. Tell us about that. And I find myself on national TV talking about William Wilberforce. Just the tiny bit that I knew was that here's a man who, because he took the Bible seriously, got involved in the battle against the slave trade, did all this amazing stuff, and I just mentioned it in the book. Next thing I know, a publisher contacts me and says, Eric, how would you like to write a biography of William Wilberforce? There's a movie coming out called Amazing Grace. It's the bicentennial of the abolition of the slave trade. What do you say? And I thought, well, I've never even thought about writing a biography. I always say I'm far too self-centered to want to spend that much time thinking about some other person for such a long time. But I prayed about it. And this is one of these rare cases, Jack, where God spoke to me in a way that was unmistakable. I knew that I should do this. And I did it, and it was tough, but it was also a joy. And I found myself traveling around the country talking about Wilberforce. People loved the writing in the book. It gave me an opportunity to exercise my literary gifts, to be a literary writer writing in this genre of biography. And the most important part to me was communicating the life of an incredible servant of God. Wilberforce's story, the fact that most of us don't know it, is just a crime. This is one of the greatest Christians who's ever lived in history. We all need to be inspired. So I wrote the book, and I'd go around the country talking about it, and people would say, hey, who are you going to write about next? And I heard that often enough that I thought if ever I were to write another biography, I might write one about Bonhoeffer, because I remember the summer I came to faith, again, 25 years ago, my friend who was leading me to faith gave me a copy of Bonhoeffer's Cost of Discipleship. And I remember reading it at the time and thinking, wow, what an amazing man. I've never encountered a Christian like this. And I also was touched because, as I said, my mom is German, grew up in Nazi Germany, went through the hell of that period, lost her father. And to read about a German who did the right thing because of his faith in Jesus, who stood up for the Jews because of his Christian faith, I said, this is so amazing. And I began wondering, okay, maybe I should write a second biography about Bonhoeffer. And of course, that's what I did. I never expected it would be so successful. I mean, nobody knows better than I that I truly had no clue that this book would sell well. In fact, I had great trial writing it and getting it published. I had to switch publishers. Very painful episode in my life, to be quite honest. Very, very painful. Just crying out to God, praying, saying, Lord, if you want to use this book, you do your will, because I'm at the end of myself. It was just a very painful time. And the book has been a multiple bestseller and enabled me to, as you mentioned earlier, you know, meet the President of the United States. In fact, I spent an hour with George W. Bush before the prayer breakfast a year before. I got to spend an hour with George W. Bush. So I met President Bush, I met President Obama, and the book's now been translated into, if you can believe it, 15 languages. I don't think I can believe that, so I say it to remind myself that this is actually happening. But what a gift. What a gift. And the story of Bonhoeffer, of course, speaks so powerfully to all of us. That's why it's been successful. We need to be inspired, and this is a true story of a true saint of God in the middle of a hellish time. So that's the long answer. Would you prefer the short answer? I can give you the short answer.
And he goes on to become a martyr, of course. If he was alive today, Eric Bonhoeffer, what would he tell us about the state of things in America today?
Well, that's the thing. Because I do go around the country speaking about Bonhoeffer so often, I get this question, and I talk about this a lot, and I think that there is not any doubt that there are parallels to where the church is today in America and where the church was in Germany in the 30s, that a lot of times people just don't see stuff coming. They're asleep, and Bonhoeffer was a prophetic voice trying to wake up the church in Germany, and I think his story today is God's prophetic voice speaking through Bonhoeffer to the American church to give us a second chance, because we are asleep on this issue of the state, the government, and the culture pushing against the church. We kind of have always had a reasonably happy relationship. We don't realize that the church has to be the church, and that sometimes involves taking a heroic stance against the state and saying, the church will be the church. We will not allow you to take away our religious freedoms to tell us what to think. The government is now telling Americans what to think and say on the issue of, for example, sexuality or marriage. Well, in this country, we are supposed to be able to have the freedom to think and say what we like. It's called being free. It's called expressing our religious freedom. This has been something, a gift given to us by the founders from the beginning. We've really lost sight. Almost all Americans, and definitely the church, doesn't really know what that is. I often refer to a book by my friend Oz Guinness called A Free People's Suicide. I recommend this book as highly as I can recommend a book, A Free People's Suicide. It talks about America and the founders' vision and religious freedom. And in A Free People's Suicide, you kind of get the template of what the founders had in mind. And you understand that if you take away religious freedom, the whole thing comes apart. That is what's happening in America today. The church, above all, needs to wake up to this, but every American needs to wake up to this. This is not just a thing for Christians. This is a thing for anybody who cares about freedom for everybody, freedom to speak our mind, to practice our religion, or to practice our irreligion. The point is, freedom means that we have the freedom to say stupid things, to think stupid things. The government cannot tell us if what we're saying is right or wrong when it comes to religious freedom. And I think that we need to understand that. It's not about arguing what is right and wrong. It's arguing about freedom. And we've, again, lost the ability to understand what we're losing, because we don't really appreciate what we had in the first place. And I think we need to wake up to that. To me, that's what Bonhoeffer was doing in Germany. It's exactly what he would be doing today, because it's just the same thing.
A lot of people listening tonight believe what you're saying, and they believe that we're in a fight for the soul of America. But then the majority of people are like Lawrence Welk. Everything is wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. You know, and they say, you're crazy, you people.
Yeah.
If there's a listener that says, Eric, you've got a platform, you're a great speaker, but I can't speak out. I get ridiculed when I say something.
Well, yeah, if you say dumb things, we have to be careful that what we do say is not just in the flesh, as we Christians call it. When, you know, we've got to speak humbly and lovingly, and if we're just speaking in anger or something, you know, God can't really use that. I think that we have to know what we believe, and we have to care about what we believe, and we have to speak out humbly and lovingly when God gives us the opportunity. It's not our job to change the world. It's our job to obey God and to bravely speak the truth in love when we have that opportunity. And everybody's different. Not everyone's called to, you know, get on a soapbox and talk about these things. But when you have small moments to talk about these things, I mean, one thing that I've begun talking about, and again, I'll plug my website, it's ericmetaxas.com, because on there I gave a graduation speech at Palm Beach Atlantic University. Wonderful opportunity for me, an honor to speak to all these young people on the day they graduate from college. But in that speech, I talk about what is the Bible's version, what is the Christian story about marriage. And when you think about what Christians believe about marriage, Christians believe that the union of man and woman is a picture of the union of God with his bride, the church. Now, when you think about that, it takes it beyond the realm of sexuality and politics. It's this glorious, noble vision. This is what the scripture and the church have taught for 2,000 years, that the union of male and female, by the way, I also talk in the speech about how God created us in his image, male and female. He takes both of those concepts seriously, and the union of them is a picture of the union of God with his bride, the church. Now, people don't have to agree with that. People that say it's the dumbest thing I ever heard, that's not relevant. The point is, that's what Christians have believed for 2,000 years, and we need to know that's what we believe, that this union is a picture of something glorious and eternal, the union of God with his bride. We need to talk about that. And so when people, you know, want to accuse us of being bigots or something, say, listen, this is what I'm talking about. You need to understand this is what we believe for 2,000 years. We need to know what we believe. But anyway, that's something I've been talking about lately, and I'll probably continue to talk about that.
We're talking to Eric Metaxas. His latest book, newest book, is entitled Seven Men and the Secret of Their Greatness. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. This is Anything is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Rasula, and we're with Eric Metaxas, whose latest book, Seven Men and the Secret of Their Greatness. The seven men are Wilberforce, we've already talked about, Bonhoeffer, George Washington, Eric Little, Jackie Robinson, John Paul II the Great, and the late Chuck Colson. Let's talk about Eric Little.
Eric Little, a lot of people know who that is if they saw the movie Chariots of Fire. That was one of the great movies of our time, won all kinds of awards, made by non-Christians, and it's probably the most Christian movie to ever, you know, win Oscars. Just an incredible story of faith. And the story of Eric Little, for those who don't know it, he was probably the fastest man on planet Earth in 1924. He was a Scotsman, the son of missionaries, went on to the mission field himself, and he was in line to get the gold medal in the 100-yard dash for the Olympics, 1924 in Paris. But it turned out that the first heat for that race was on a Sunday. And Eric Little and his family, these Scotch Presbyterians, faithful Christians, said, you know what, we call Sunday the Sabbath. We don't do that stuff on Sunday. Sorry, I can't do it. Everybody went apoplectic. You've got to be joking. This is an opportunity to give the first gold medal in the history of the Olympics to Scotland. Are you crazy? Are you patriotic? What is your story? And he said, listen, I have to honor God. I cannot run on the Sabbath. I won't run on the Sabbath. He stuck to his guns. He knew that if he did something and he didn't think it was God's will, there's no way he would win the race. He knew that he had to run for God or not at all. It's just a story, like every one of the stories in Seven Men, of noble, heroic sacrifice. That's what it really is to be a great man, to take your strength, to take your greatest abilities and submit them to God's purposes. And that's the story we need to tell our young people. It's especially the story we need to tell young men. But it really is something that we haven't been doing in the culture. And the story of every one of these seven men, I picked them because they illustrate this, that they're not just great for their achievements. They're great for the noble sacrifice they made at a time that most people would have said, you know, you're crazy. What are you doing? And they said, no, I'm not crazy. I am doing this because I believe this is the right thing to do. And in every one of these cases, we can see what it cost them. It really cost them something. And yet, it's such a beautiful story. And, you know, you can't outgive God. When you honor God, as Eric Little says, that I will honor God, and he honors those who honor him. It's just a powerful illustration of what happens. He ended up winning the gold medal anyway, which is truly miraculous. I won't tell that story, but that's, of course, in the book. And then he went on to the mission field and did all kinds of other sacrificial things, which, if you can believe it, are even greater than what he did in the Olympics. That's the story that, you know, the movie doesn't tell. So every one of these stories, I felt this idea that I've got to tell it because people need to know, especially young men. They need heroes. That's really the idea behind the book, is that young men need heroes. We all need heroes, but especially young men and men in general. We need to know, what does it mean to be a great man? We've got a crisis of manhood in the culture. That's really why I wrote the book.
Speaking of movies, many of us have just watched 42, the story of Jackie Robinson. What impressed you the most about Jackie Robinson?
Well, the funny thing is, I didn't even know this movie was going to come out when I wrote the book. I just knew the story of Jackie Robinson back from my days working for Chuck Colson, who, as you mentioned, is the seventh man in the book. I remember encountering the story of Jackie Robinson and realizing, oh my goodness, he was a believer. I never knew that. And then you find out that not only was he a profound Christian believer, but everything he did, this huge sacrifice that he made to not fight back when any red-blooded male would have wanted to fight back and probably would have fought back, of course, he lays that on God's altar and says, I will not fight back. I'm going to do this for the larger good, to break the color barrier for these young people who are going to follow in decades in the future. I'm going to sacrifice this myself. He does all this, but he does it in large part because of his faith in Jesus. And then we find out, even crazier, the man who recruited him for the Brooklyn Dodgers, the famous Branch Rickey, was himself a very, very serious Christian, wouldn't even go to ball games on a Sunday. And he says, I'm going to pick this Christian man because I know he's going to turn the other cheek. He's going to understand that's a command from Jesus. And in their first meeting, and this is all in my book, you don't see this in the movie, he opens up a book and shares with Jackie Robinson Jesus' words from the Sermon on the Mount about turning the other cheek. That actually happened. It's not made up. The title of the book was The Life of Christ. This actually happened at the seminal moment in 20th century civil rights history. They don't put any of that in the movie. Now, it's a good movie, but, you know, they do not get into the faith thing. They don't get into the fact that Robinson was on his knees praying for strength to get through this time. So it's just an amazing story. And again, I said every American needs to know this story. What an amazing story.
When you first wrote the book, you had Abraham Lincoln as one of the seven. And then Chuck Colson dies.
Yes.
You know, who went to prison for Pentagon Papers in the Nixon White House.
Yep.
And you eliminate Abraham Lincoln and put Colson in.
Well, I think Lincoln's gotten enough press this year, wouldn't you say?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, no, the funny thing is that I said I'm not going to put any living people in the book. You know, I'm going to only put people who have passed on. And Chuck, I had the privilege of knowing him, working for him, becoming his friend later in life. And in fact, I had the privilege of introducing his last speech just a little bit over a year ago. I was there when he fell ill and was put on the ambulance. It was just a dramatic turn of events, and now I'm the voice of Breakpoint. That's a whole other crazy blessing from God. But when Chuck was on his deathbed, I said, you know, he needs to be the seventh man. We knew he wasn't going to make it. And I said, there's no chance that I could leave him out. He's a great man. His story is as great as any of the stories in this book. And so I put him in the book, and it ended up that Chuck bumped Abraham Lincoln. I think they're probably joking about it right now.
Speaking of Breakpoint, that was started by Colson in 91.
Yep.
And you're the daily host, 1,400 radio outlets per day.
Yeah, it's it's a strange thing to be able to speak to so many people. I don't know how many actual listeners we have or how this, you know, radio world works. One thing I know is that when I go around the country, people come up to me and say, I listen to Breakpoint every morning. Thank you for Breakpoint. I always say you can get it mailed to your email inbox. Just go to breakpoint.org and sign up, and every morning you'll get it. 2 days of the week it's my friend John Stonestreet. 3 days of the week it's me, and I just think that, you know, this is Christian worldview stuff that everybody needs to know, and so if you miss it on the radio, at least get it in your inbox. Again, it's breakpoint.org. Well worth the 3 minutes a day if you can spare it.
God works in strange ways. I heard this from Chuck Colson once, that this Lech Walesa in the Gdansk shipyards,
yeah,
and then we get this Polish Pope, Pope John Paul. We get Reagan, we get Margaret Thatcher, we get Gorbachev, and basically those five, with an awful lot of prayers, freed hundreds of millions of people from communism without one bullet. Talk to us about John Paul II the Great.
Well, this is the thing. You know, I'm not a Catholic, but when you know the story of this man, it needs to be said as well that he was a real man's man. This was an athlete, a heroic man who, you know, a skier, a runner. He was just this incredibly vibrant, youthful figure for most of his life. When he first became the Pope in 1978, I remember I was 15 at the time, the whole world was captivated. Who is this smiling, charming paragon of faith? Who's this man? And, you know, he was a great man. We didn't know what it would lead to, but God knew that this man would be used by God to help bring down the Soviet Union. Who can imagine? Well, God can imagine. And this man, he was a man of prayer. I think his story needs to be known. A lot of people just don't know who he was and what a hero he was. So there's no doubt in my mind that he belongs in the book Seven Men.
Another thing that Chuck Colson did was be the key drafter of the Manhattan Declaration. When we come back, we'll ask Eric Metaxas about the Manhattan Declaration. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to Eric Metaxas, whose latest book, Seven Men and the Secret of Their Greatness. You're now involved with the Manhattan Declaration Project. Tell us about that document that Chuck Colson was so instrumental in crafting.
Well, this is where you see Chuck Colson was a prophet in a way, because he saw the dangers, the threat to religious freedom years ago. He was talking about this years ago, and he said, we need to take a stand now as Christians, any kind of Christian, Catholic, Protestant, Evangelical, Pentecostal, Eastern Orthodox, liberal, conservative, doesn't matter. If you're a Christian, you need to know that your faith is going to be threatened and that we need to stand up to it. And so in 2009, he, Robert George of Princeton, the great legal scholar at Princeton, and then Timothy George, no relation, at Beeson Divinity School, theological scholar, got together and drafted a document called the Manhattan Declaration. People can go to manhattandeclaration.org, O-R-G. And they said, we're going to talk about the three things that are really under threat right now, or that appear that they're going to be under threat. Number one, just marriage, traditional marriage, this old-fashioned idea of a man and a woman coming together for life. This is something that suddenly looks like on the horizon is going to be attacked. We need to very clearly state winsomely that this is the Christian belief about this. We need to talk about the life issue, the unborn. Will we be forced by government to subsidize taking that innocent life? Will we be forced to participate in abortions if we are nurses or doctors? How does that all work? We need to spell that out. And then we need to talk about religious freedom in general, the third issue. If I have certain views that are part of my Christian faith, what does that mean if the government is pushing me to stand against that? So they laid this out in this beautiful document called the Manhattan Declaration. I urge everyone who's listening, please go to manhattandeclaration.org and sign up and read it and share it with your friends. It's very, very important. And so, amazingly, this document, you know, goes out, and a couple of years later, suddenly all these things are happening. We have a president of the United States come out vocally for legally redefining marriage. It doesn't matter what you think about it. The idea of legally redefining it, that's where it gets scary, because you're monkeying with laws, and that's going to affect people, and it's already affecting people. I just read a report yesterday by the Department of Justice requiring their employees to affirm the idea of same-sex marriage. It's not enough that you don't speak in a bigoted way. Now you're obliged to publicly affirm. I mean, that's going to go against anybody who says that I'm a serious Christian. It's going to go against your Orthodox teaching. How do you do that? I mean, these things are happening right now. And so Chuck Colson saw it, and as I say, it's happening. ManhattanDeclaration.org is the place to go. I hope folks will take that seriously and read it and sign it and share it with their friends. It's a very humble, winsome document. It's not intended to be political or incendiary or partisan in any way. And that's what's, to me, the key about Chuck Colson, is he understands that. It's not about being a culture warrior. It's about being a winsome, faithful witness of Jesus Christ and Christian views, which in part have to do with civility and how we say what we say.
You mentioned that Colson said, we have to stand up for what we believe. Bonhoeffer once said, and I quote, silence in the face of evil is itself evil. Getting back to Colson, he had an autistic grandson, Max.
Yeah.
And Chuck said, that grandson changed my life.
Mm-hmm.
How?
Well, gosh, in many ways. I think, first of all, it awoke him to the idea of the handicapped, and how, just like Chuck worked for 35 years in prisons with the least of these, quote-unquote, he realized that there are handicapped people all around the world and families of handicapped people, and they're carrying a burden. His own daughter, Emily, I've had the privilege of meeting not very long ago, is dealing with a son who is handicapped. Now, first of all, I think we need to say that technology would eliminate all of these people through abortion. And this is one thing that needs to be discussed. In my Bonhoeffer book, I talk about how the Nazis had this eugenics vision. You know, Margaret Sanger in the United States was right there with this idea of eliminating all those we don't like or that are going to cause us problems. Well, that certainly includes autistic children. So when you have a child that is dealing with Down syndrome or with autism or something like that, to think that the government is pushing and pushing people to say, you just eliminate them before they're ever born, you know, we don't need to deal with that, that's really significant. And this was close to Chuck's heart, this idea. But I think the way it changed Chuck, maybe even more dramatically, is it forced him to slow down. Chuck was always just the ultimate type A personality, take no prisoners. I mean, he was called the White House hatchet man. Even after he became a Christian, he still had that go, go, go personality, get stuff done. And Max forced him to slow down. He literally would have to, you know, get down on the carpet and engage his grandson and come down to his level. That's what we're called to do as Christians, because Jesus came down to our level on every level. He came down to our level, condescended to become a human being, to enter human form and flesh. And it's just an amazing picture of what God calls each of us to do. And Max was God's way, most dramatically, of speaking to Chuck about that, the idea that he needs to slow down, to come down to the level of his autistic grandson. Of course, that's a lesson for all of us. There are places in our lives where we need to do that. But it really did change Chuck. I saw it myself. I mean, when I went to work for him 16 years ago, he was different from the man that I've known in the last 3 or 4 years, just before he had passed on. He really had changed in some ways. And, you know, we have a gracious God who's perpetually sanctifying us and blessing us by making us more like him. So, you know, what an honor to see that with my own eyes in the life of my friend Chuck Colson.
You say, and I quote, our hope is in God, not in winning.
Yeah.
I always want to win.
Well, of course, and we should want to win. Absolutely, we should want to win. If you care about what's right, you want to win. The point is, it can't become an idol. You have to care about obedience to God even more. And so, you know, if Wilberforce is fighting the slave trade interests, these were horrible people doing horrible things, and you have every reason to fight, but you have to fight God's way. You have to say, you know, I'll even be willing to lose if fighting according to the flesh, fighting according to a way that would make me compromise my witness comes into play. No, I won't. My first love is God and obedience to God. And I think that we need to understand on all these issues, God says the battle belongs to me. Vengeance is mine. We have to let him do the fighting. And that's a tricky thing for a lot of us because we don't know how to do that. But I think just this concept that God says, I want you to fight with passion, but I want you to fight my way. I insist that you fight my way, drawing on my strength. You can't do it without me. That's tough, and that's humbling for people who are used to fighting their way and succeeding their way. But, you know, on all these social issues and all these things and political elections, God says, I can't help you if you are fighting in your own strength. That this is one of those things that's the ultimate paradox for human beings. How do we do that? But believe me, God wants us to figure it out. It's not some trick. So he just invites us to pray and to ask him to show us.
Last question, Eric. What would you say to the men tonight? How can they become great men?
Well, you know, it's like the author plugging his own books. The first thing I would say is I hope that they would acquaint themselves with the seven men in my book, Seven Men, because that's specifically why I wrote it. I said we need heroes and role models. We can talk all we want about, you know, ideas, but when you see a life, I mean, any of us who's had a father or some male role model who lived a certain way, that speaks more powerfully than bullet points or lessons. There's something about seeing it. So in the Seven Men, in my book, Seven Men, I wanted that to be a way of communicating so you see it. But I do think that, you know, to get to the bullet point in our remaining seconds, it means the agape love of Jesus Christ, the love that says, I will put my wife first. I will put my children first. It will cost me something, but I know God will honor me as I do that. Instead of playing a video game or doing whatever it was I was going to do to honor God, I will help my wife. I will do something for my children to do it to honor God. God cannot be outgiven. When we honor God in that way, holy cow, he comes in and blesses us and shows us things. I mean, that is tough, and you need to have discernment, but I really think that really is at the heart of what we're talking about and being a great man.
Eric Metesis, let's keep letting God use you to speak to America. Keep up the great work.
Privileged to be with you, Jack. Thanks for having me.
Please join us next Sunday. Until then, I'm Jack Krasula. Thanks for listening, and make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Shalom.